Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. My name is Zachary Strebeck, the game lawyer and your host for the podcast. And with me today, we have two wonderful folks that run a website called Game Jolt. Can you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Yaprock. I help David run Game Jolt. Game Jolt is a digital distribution platform and marketplace for indie developers to host and sell their games. And we also have a huge community of gamers obsessed with indie games.
I'm David. David DeCarmine. I started Game Jolt, it changes every time I say it. How long ago was it?
I think 2002 was the first concept.
2002, late 2002. So I've been running it for a while now.
Awesome. Yeah. So what were your, what was your background before you got into creating Game Jolt? Actually, I should ask David, right? Because he originally created it. So that's David, what was your background? What were you doing before you started Game Jolt?
Well, he was 14.
They have a background then.
A lot of taking out the garbage. And I think he used to deliver newspaper.
Yeah, there you go. The newspaper delivery guy.
Like the newsies.
No, that was later because I couldn't drive yet. So anyway, I was really into games and like what people were doing around the time, which was kind of like hobbyist game developers just doing it for fun. You know, not really commercially. And I was pretty into that, and there wasn't really a place for them to put their games up and get hosting and stuff. So it's kind of why I started it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what the indie industry was like back in 2002. I mean,
it was not called that. Yeah, it was, there wasn't really like an indie thing. I mean, at first, it was just like freeware games. That was the whole thing, right? Yep. What Jolt was. And then the term indie came around. So then I started using that as what Game Jolt's about.
Because I was doing modding for back then. What was I doing? Soldier of Fortune 2 or Quake 3, that kind of stuff. I was working on mods for that kind of stuff. There wasn't really. It's the problem was there wasn't really a good way to self-publish and distribute, right?
Yeah.
So I guess that's sort of what caused the indie boom was just the fact that you can now get a wide distribution on your games. Yaprock, what about you? How did you, or what was your background before you worked on Game Jolt?
Merchandising and supply chain, actually. Right, yeah. So has nothing to do with games or the gaming industry. But I grew up playing games thanks to my older brother. It's just I didn't actually know the existence of indie games. I did a lot of Age of Empires and Diablo and mm-hmm. So those were my jams.
The first iteration of Game Jolt was pretty small, right? So how did it kind of evolve over the next decade, I suppose, David?
So when a man loves a woman.
I see.
So I started it. Yeah, really long time ago. I was really young, didn't really know what I was doing. So I put it up as a way for anyone to be able to self-publish. And then I was trying to get developers to use it. And I remember through the first round of me kind of just cold emailing some developers, the first guy I emailed was nobody's going to add their game to this site. It's too much work, you know, nobody has time to do that because he wasn't really seeing it as a hosting thing or something that would benefit him in the end. It was more he was viewing it as I was going to get something out of it. Right. And so I don't know, being pretty young, I immediately switched my idea around, because I didn't have the fortitude, the mental fortitude. But I switched it to something where like I would put the games up, and I ran that I think for like a year or something, but it didn't really pan out. Mm-hmm. So then I shut it down, and then waited until 2008 again, actually, and then started it up again then, and that's when it took off. And I stayed with the original idea I had of, you know, anyone could come to the site and add their game. There's no like review queue or anything like that. Just completely open and free to use. And yeah, then it took off.
So. Were there more hurdles that the developer had to jump through in the beginning? Like you say, was there a review queue or anything, or was it difficult?
I think I should have just stuck with the idea.
Right.
Like it was just one developer.
Right.
And then the next thing is, it was pretty early, right? Like maybe it was a little too soon. But yeah, like people didn't really quite know what I was trying to do with it because right. there wasn't really anything like it out there. So, yeah.
So in the beginning, how did you, besides cold emailing developers, I mean, how did you market the website to people? Was it just through word of mouth that it started growing, or?
Yeah, so I guess like the second launch when it was actually pretty successful, I still like just emailed some developers that I found, and that was actually a really good way at the beginning, because even when I relaunched it, there was nothing really like it out there. Mm-hmm. And so that worked out pretty well. And then I also went on forums because those used to be a thing.
I still go on forums every day. I don't know.
Well, at least there's you.
You were going on BBSs and stuff.
Yeah, BBS. There we go. Yeah, no, I joke around a little bit, but I guess there's a few. So, I went around on forums telling people what I was trying to do and like, you know, kind of communicating with them where they already were, kind of discussing about like indie games. And a lot of times it would be like different like engines and stuff that people were using.
Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah. And that actually worked out pretty well, and it gave me like a good way of kind of naturally getting involved in their communities.
I mean, what you bring up is exactly what I would tell people if they were a new developer trying to get some kind of buzz for their game or whatever. You really have to go to where, you know, the community is, where they're talking about games, and try to not only advertise your game or talk about your game, but really sort of get into the community and help them out. It makes you someone that they care about and want to see you be successful, right? So when you are giving 90% of the time, and then that 10% of the time you say, hey, now I'm trying out my game, you know, I put it on Kickstarter or whatever, you know, when you give back to them, or when you give to them first and don't ask for something right away, generally they're more apt to help you out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And definitely forums and Reddit and all those places. If you can help people out there, it's a great idea to start marketing yourself that way. Especially if nobody knows who you are.
It's just a lot of work.
Sure. So, I mean, you guys, obviously community is very important to you. How did you start to build, and how do you currently maintain your community? What do you do? Yeah, Brian.
What do we do? Right now, I'd say anyone who is anyone knows Game Jolt.
Uh-huh. So. Only the coolest people. No. Yeah.
No, the cool thing about working on Game Jolt and with tons of indies versus like a big corporation or like a company is that people respond to really good products.
Mm-hmm.
So we're finding that we just identify the pain points of developers or gamers that use the site, and we try to make it easier for them, or we come up with features that, you know, like they wouldn't even know would help them out a ton.
Right.
Right. And we execute that. So, and then it seems like word of mouth does really well. And then we have a ton of followers on Twitter and Facebook and stuff. So people are constantly checking our blog when we release new features and updates and stuff too. So it seems like I see this as like a big blob. That's our community, and it just kind of like expands and takes over. So I think it's gotten to a point where anyone who's developing games independently knows of Game Jolt.
I will say around community is kind of funny. At the beginning, I put in like a chat. It was like one of the first things I added on Game Jolt because I was really, really into building chats at the time.
Okay.
They're kind of like hard to build. So, at the time it was pretty fun. Anyway, so like I put it like always visible on the right side of the page. And so anytime, and I also allowed guests to chat, which was fine at the beginning and then it turned into a nightmare.
Sure.
But, understand that. Yeah. So like anytime I saw a user pop on, I would like be like, hey, blah, 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 you know, and they'd like maybe see the message on the right and be like, what the heck? And so I actually grew the community like pretty well through that. I think like there was a bunch of like even kind of like big people that I just kind of like screamed at until I got their attention. Like that was funny. And then the interesting thing now though is that the site is so big that these kind of ways that worked really well at the beginning no longer work. Right. And it's kind of like we also have like two or three audiences on Game Jolt. So there's not just like developers, there's also gamers. There's actually way more gamers than developers, right? And sometimes the two kind of audiences don't always want to communicate to one another. Like they're fairly different. And so it's been pretty interesting as we've grown to like still try to keep some sort of community going, but it's almost like impossible a little. And what I've noticed is that rather than one big Game Jolt community, it's actually a lot of small ones. And you'll see it like, yeah, they'll talk more on each other's like game pages, like, or they'll talk, they talk a lot in like comments, kind of like one-on-one to each other.
Right.
And so it's like really spread across the site and it's almost impossible for like, you know, either one of us to really be involved in everything going on.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, once you scale up past a certain point, right, it's hard to do it individually. That's interesting. What are some ways you think that you could sort of promote developer to gamer talk? Because actually, I think it's super important when you're developing a game to actually be communicating with your potential audience, right? Even before you start developing the game, to know what your audience wants and the people that would eventually download your game or pay for your game. They're your customers. I think a lot of people, especially in games, approach it from the other end, like what game would I want to make? What game do I want to play? That kind of thing. And then they just make the game, and then whether, they wonder why they had no success or nobody downloaded the game. It's because they're making a game that they want to play rather than people, potentially end users want to play. And so I think if there's more interaction between the audiences, potential audiences, and the developer itself, it definitely helps the developer. Do you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And we've actually created certain things where we force developers to have to depend on gamers and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if your game is in the marketplace and you just set it as, like pay what you want versus actually making it cost money, then gamers who contribute, any money, or even if you did have a fixed price, if they contribute more than that amount, they show up, their avatars show up on the game page. So it's kind of like a cool competition to try to get gamers to support indie devs.
Right.
And I think in return, developers are super grateful for all the, you know, support that they receive. So that's one way. And did you want to talk about devlogs?
Yeah. So actually going to your point of like building a game and then being like, oh man, people don't like this. Right. We have a devlog system that we released this year. Yeah, it's still this year.
this will go up before the end of the year, so it still will be this year when many people
listen. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. 2016. So, yeah, that we released. And the idea is that it's kind of like, well, it's a devlog. So, like, as you're working on the game, you put out, like, posts about it. Mm-hmm. And they can be, you know, really short form, kind of like tweet ones or longer ideas. They could be images, all these things. And then we have like a following system with activity feeds. So like all the games that you follow, those posts will go into your activity feed and you get like notifications for it. Mm-hmm. So I've actually seen like this work out really, really well for people. So even before they have a game that's playable, they'll make a devlog and start like, sometimes they do like really, really detailed posts about like game mechanics and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they'll even show their like concept sketches and like whiteboarding things. And it's actually really, really cool. Like the interaction that they get from then gamers. So I'd say like Game Jolt is maybe the main focus is to try to get gamers and developers interacting together more. I would say just some developers are maybe a little too cool for school. But yeah, I think that works out really well. Then even like off of Game Jolt, there's, you know, a lot of developers now doing Twitch streams.
Yep.
And getting really good feedback that way. I popped on a bunch and they're always fun.
On those kind of streams and those kind of things, is it more other developers that are getting excited about that or are gamers like watching them programming a game? Is that exciting for the gamer?
I think it depends, but I've definitely seen gamers go on, and especially when the developer, I think it's, you know, it depends a lot on what you're doing. If you're just kind of like showing people while you work, uh-huh, it's not maybe as interesting, but if you get a lot of them get actual feedback from the people watching, right? And they'll actually like change what their work, like, yeah, what they're implementing or doing
right.
on feedback. And so I think those ones probably do better with gamers.
Do you find that it's because the audience, the indie game player audience, is maybe a little more into the development process and sort of the whole indie vibe rather than like, if you had Call of Duty programmers programming the game or whatever, maybe their audience wouldn't necessarily care. You know, maybe unfairly stereotyping Call of Duty players, but, you know, just sort of the mainstream gamer doesn't really care about that. But the people who want to play indie games, they're more interested in, like, the story of the development and all that. I mean, there was that indie game, the movie, and I think people were really interested in that and just sort of, like, the more personal side of game development and how, you know, the lifestyle is and all of that. I think, do you think that it's a question of, you know, that specific audience and that's the kind of thing that they want to know?
Yeah, I think indie games are pretty unique. And then, like, the kinds of gamers that it draws in, mm-hmm, can also be kind of unique. I think, yeah, I mean, from my experience, but it might just be because, like, Game Jolt's sort of built around this concept. But it seems like they're very, like, they want to be involved in some way,
right?
You know,
right?
They don't want to just consume like games. I think they want to also kind of like contribute in some way, and that's why I think you see so many, like, you know, let's players as well. Sure. In the indie space. Well, one thing, it's like pretty cheap since there's so many free games, but also, you know, it's really, really cool to actually be involved in the industry in some way, even if you're not making the game.
Yeah, I agree. Or you could be like me and try to be a lawyer for game developers. it's still my way. Because I used to be an artist and did animation, but I don't think it was actually very good. So this is my way of giving back and getting into the industry again as in something that I'm much better at than when I was an artist.
Sure. Let's see. When are you going to do a Twitch stream for lawyering?
Can you even imagine? That'd be great.
I would watch that. I would actually watch that.
I would need to get a release from the client, but I'm sure, yeah, that would be something.
Yes. I was joking around, but that would be like really informative.
Yes. Actually, no, it's funny because I do want to do some teaching, and I think I want to make videos and things like that of like, how do you register your copyright, right? So a lot of indie developers just don't have a lot of money to hire someone like me to do all this stuff for them. But that doesn't mean that it's not super important that they register a trademark or a copyright.
Yeah.
And so maybe, yeah, I stream, hey, look, I'm registering a trademark for myself, right? And now you can watch the process and you can see how it goes and I can have that archived. I think actually that's probably a good idea. And that's maybe one of the ways that I would add value to whatever kind of teaching material I come up with. It's a pretty good idea. So you guys, I met you in person. I can never remember. That was at GDC, right, this year?
Yeah, that was March.
Yes, in March. What conventions have you guys gone to, and do you think you're getting any value out of that? Because I know that for a lot of developers, whether or not to spend the money to go to conventions is always sort of a big question. And do you think that you get the value out of that by meeting the gamers and other developers? Yeah.
So I have very strong opinions over this. Okay. And obviously what we do for Game Joel is not going to really be relatable for like a smaller indie dev studio,
right.
But I'll continue venting anyway. So
please do.
At GDC in March, I keep saying last year and I probably will continue saying it because it's fine. It feels
so long ago.
Yeah. We like got a booth. So we saved up for like 3 years because this is something that we really wanted to do. And we got like a huge booth and showed like, I don't know, 70 something games. And then we threw like a pretty awesome party. There was like 300 people that came through. And we like really did it big. And, first, I'll talk about like the cool parts of that. The cool parts of that was that we managed to show like a shitload of indie games, which kind of, you know, they're not really highlighted at events like GDC just because they tend to be more for like professional, sure. Like money, basically,
yeah.
Like profit for profit type of stuff. So that was the cool thing. And our stance there, we had actually just launched, we were going to launch a marketplace. So instead of showing paid games, we strictly showed free games. And then we had like extra expo passes. So we gave them to some of the developers that were able to come out to San Francisco so that they could actually show off their game at GDC themselves, which is really cool because most of them hadn't even been to GDC before because, you know, like flying to San Francisco, like staying at a shitty hotel and all that. Like it ends up being
even the shitty hotels are ridiculously expensive at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was like a really cool opportunity for them. And you could tell that they were like really excited to be there. So that part was awesome. And then our party was awesome. There was like we forced everyone at our party to meet each other. So there was like tons of people there. And they, at the end of the night, like everyone had met each other, which was really awesome. So walking away from GDC, I'll just speak for myself. I was pretty bummed that the only, you know, like the headline and coverage that came from it was the Microsoft Exotic Dancers.
Right, I remember.
I don't know if you remember that happening, yeah. But I guess they threw a party and
schoolgirl outfits or something?
Strippers or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which like sucks and I think it should be highlighted, but it was just a bummer for people like us who, you know, like we've been saving up so much to like be there and literally no coverage. And if we couldn't get covered, you know, like as an indie studio, like without connections, you're also not going to get covered. So it might be my recommendation for going to GDC is to get like the cheap expo pass, or even like do the 5-minute speaker stuff that they have where they give you a free pass, and then just go and like plan as many meetings as possible so that you can like talk to the right people, network. But I've just like, I've been going to GDC for, I don't know, like 4-ish years or something like that now. And it seems like the parties are really where it's at. Like if I was, you know, like a smaller studio, I definitely go to the parties and try and network there. But so that was my big vent on GDC. But we also went to Develop Conference in Brighton in the UK.
Okay.
And that was pretty cool. So that was like a smaller GDC, like a tiny, tiny, tiny version of GDC. And the only reason why I would even compare it to GDC is because of the quality of speakers that go. So for that, like, do whatever you can to get like the pass that will let you into the speakers, because the rooms are really small. There's like 5 to 20 people attending the like the events. And then afterwards you can actually like have quality one-on-one time with the speakers. So I would almost like say screw GDC, save up your money and like fly to frickin' Brighton and for that, because I think it would definitely be worth it. And then we went to REST in London, right? Was it REST?
Yeah, I forget that one.
Which was,
oh yeah, at the dock thing.
Which was like, I guess their version of PAX, again, like way smaller than PAX. And the only reason why it's relatable is because there's tons of games and it's open to the public. Like PAXes, you just buy a ticket and go.
Right.
I think that oftentimes if you're a game studio, it might not make sense to exhibit. I think what could do really well is if you're able to get on a panel to talk, that's actually a good way to get your name and your game out there. And sometimes even get free ticket then to the show if you're a speaker.
Yeah.
I mean, so yeah, I don't know. It's pretty expensive to exhibit, especially for indies. So I'm not sure that's the best use of resources.
Right.
But, you know, getting into the events, I think depending on the event, it can be really beneficial for networking.
Yeah, like, I can definitely see that.
Just being, you know, at the place, going to parties or like whatever,
right?
Show floors and stuff.
Yeah, I found that I've been to a bunch of conventions in the last year, and I don't know. I think I'm going to scale it way back this year, just because I just haven't gotten a lot out of it. It's nice to meet people. It's great to meet clients, especially with my lifestyle, where I'm not usually, and I have clients from all over the country, so. And of the world, really. So a lot of them go to these conventions and I can actually finally meet them face to face, which is totally cool. But aside from giving me an excuse to travel somewhere and mark it as a business expense, I'm not entirely sure that I'm getting a lot out of actually going to these. So this year, actually, I think, or this year. See, now I'm talking about 2017 is this year. 2017, I think I'm just going to do a couple. Maybe Gen Con, which is the big board game convention. So that's sort of the one I love going to. And then maybe PAX Australia I'll go to, just to, as I've never been to Australia, so I might as well go there. Maybe go to New Zealand after that. It'd be fun.
Yeah, is the PAX Australia in Melbourne?
Or I Melbourne? Believe Melbourne. Yeah, I think so. Wow. Yes, it is.
Yeah, there's like a big group of indies over there.
Very cool. Very cool. So, yeah, maybe I can try to set things up. I don't know. You know, what I can do for Australian developers is a little bit limited, but if they want to do some US stuff, I can definitely help them out. So I'll try to see what I can do there. Okay. So you recently, is it recently now, opened up a marketplace, sort of a paid section of the Game Jolt site. When was that actually? That wasn't that recent, was it?
No, I mean, it feels recent, yeah. But we launched in May, and okay. We didn't just open it up to everyone because we wanted to make sure that, you know, like we're completely tax compliant and we just do everything the legal way. And there's a lot of like really boring and frustrating tax stuff with like foreign sellers,
yeah.
And players. So we've had it closed off to just kind of watch for a long time. So we only really did like a soft launch. But recently with the release of the Game Jolt Partner Program, mm-hmm. where we formally, you know, included and invited Let's Players onto Game Jolt, it's becoming marketplace is growing a lot more. So do you want to talk about the partner program a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it's the idea is it's kind of like a referral system for mm-hmm. Let's Players and streamers. So basically, if they're a big enough Let's Player with enough subscribers or followers, then they can get into a partner program and get marketplace games for free, just automatically on their account, as long as those games are opted in. So like the developer chooses to opt in.
Sure.
And then, yeah, the partners can then find the games, play them for free, make videos and include a link and then get a cut of the sale.
I should do that with when I'm streaming myself drafting their contracts. I can put a link in there and yeah, get a cut of that. Be like, hey, check out the game that this contract is for.
There you go.
That could work.
Yes. Always thinking of the business yeah. side of things. All right. Please continue.
Oh, I was just going to say that it's been fun. It's kind of... it's pretty cool watching like the community come together and help one another. So, like the partner program and the marketplace is kicking pretty cool.
Great. How do you find the willingness of maybe Game Jolt audience specifically, but just, indie game players in general? Are they willing to pay at least something for games? I know with the popularity of Humble Bundle, it sounds like, you know, they're cheap. I don't want to say cheap in a negative way, but you know, they're cheap. They don't want to spend a ton of money, especially on maybe an unproven game, but they don't seem unwilling to pay something. Right. And I think maybe it's.
Yeah. So there's like a misconception that indie games should be cheap mm-hmm. and it's not just like cheap, like, cause they're already pretty cheap compared yeah. to AAA. Definitely. But, I think because of the App Store and yeah. the idea of having like a smaller or like shorter game kind of like paints this picture that it should be like pennies or a dollar or something, yeah. you know, but that's not, I think that's like a really wrong way of looking at it.
There's a few things like 2D games versus 3D games. I think a 2D game generally has less value attributed to it, right? Because I don't know, there's a perception that less work went into it or something like that if it's not realistic looking or whatever. And then games without multiplayer or maybe story games, things like that. There's all kinds of games that I think gamers have sort of, you know, what do you call that? There's a relative value between all of them. And I think people have sort of made up their minds what they want to pay for as far as those games go, no matter how much work went into them, it doesn't really matter. But I think, you know, Wemby, one of the problems is that these sort of the Call of Duty and the AAA games have just stuffed so much crap into the games. It's just multiplayer. There's campaign. There's zombie mode. There's this. There's that. And then it, you know, they're almost over overstuffing the game with things, with value, so that it makes the perception of the value of the smaller games a lot lower.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's been, I think there's definitely a, like, a weird issue with pricing, and I think there's a few things to blame, right? Like, bundles, I think, don't really help. I think maybe it helps the people in the bundle at the time if they get enough sales, but then everyone else is, you know, maybe not feeling so good. And then what other things? Stuff like mobile app stores, right? Kind of give you this idea that, like, you know, maybe non AAA games should be really cheap or
free, mostly free.
Yeah. Or free, right? Yeah. And then even on Game Jolt, there's so many like free games, right? So then how do we charge money? And I think it's generally been pretty fine though. But it's definitely, people have like a weird, you know, that weird idea of like how much it should be. And
Steam sales don't help either, right?
That's a lot of people are focused on sales, right? Yeah. And you know, if you see any percentage off, then you might consider it. But you know, if it's not on a sale, why would I ever, you know, buy it? Unless it's a AAA game. And even then though. But so I think it is kind of like hard for indies that are maybe trying to stay indie and not, you know, go with a publisher, especially. But I don't know. One thing we've noticed is that, like, if your game is priced really, really low and you're, you know, expecting that because it's priced low, you're going to get enough sales to, you know, make up the difference.
Right.
It actually seems not so true. Like, it seemed like if somebody wants to buy the game, they're going to be willing to spend more money on it. At least that's what we've seen.
Right.
So
the multiplier just goes way up, right? If you do $2 instead of $10 or something, right?
Exactly.
Now you have to sell five times as many games.
And I think like there's this weird, you know, like the difference between $2 and $10 is actually a lot, right?
Sure.
But in people's minds, not so much. Like $10 is still really low, you know?
For a game.
For a game that somebody's probably spent years on.
And, assuming that the value is in the game, right? There's some sort of replayability.
Like 2.5 copies.
Exactly. Well, and I think, that's the problem. And that's what's kind of so toxic about how things have shifted so much as far as the value of these games, like with the app stores and things, is that in the grand scheme of things, it's still super cheap to buy a $10 game or a $15 game. But when you see, you know, two digits there, you're like, oh, $10, you know, now you, even me, like I should have no problem paying for this, but it's like, whoa, $10, maybe I can wait for a sale. it just becomes your natural inclination, I think. Not that I'm some rich, fancy lawyer or anything. I don't want to give that impression, but you know, I should be able to spend $10 on a game. And I often do. I mean, I back Kickstarters just because, and I don't even want the game. I just want, you know, to just put some money in there. Now I'm overcompensating, I think. But yeah. okay. No, I agree. I definitely agree with you. I think it's an issue. Watch my stream. one of the things about you guys that's sort of near and dear to my heart is that until recently, maybe a few months ago, you guys were sort of digitally nomadic, correct?
Yes, we were just like you.
Yes, just like me. Just so you guys work a lot more than I do, I think.
David, over a year ago, I was trying to plan our honeymoon because David and I didn't get to go on our honeymoon because we had a family member pass during our wedding, which was not fun. But I wanted to plan our honeymoon. And then David was like, what if we just go and we just never come back? And then working from home at the time, like, on Game Jolt, right? Like, I didn't really have a reason not to. So I was like, all right, let's do it. And he's like, what if we go, we don't come back, but we go to a different country every single month? And again, like, there's really no way to say no to that because we work from our laptops. Yes. Like, we don't need anything. So, yeah, we cut our lease short, and then we got rid of most of our crap and put the rest in storage, and then moved into a tiny house for a month, and then just, you know, like, left the country, went to Italy, Prague, Austria,
a lot of countries in Europe.
So we counted 12 total. So we did 12 countries in 12 months.
And we went to Australia. So take that.
yeah, I'll be there soon. I actually almost bought a ticket to Australia yesterday. So
yeah. And then our families and friends thought that we were just like on this permanent vacation.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
So we had to tell them like, hey, we're actually like working nonstop. We probably work like 12 to 14 hour days. And then just during the weekends, we would like go out and be somewhere new, which was really fun. So like, Portugal, Lisbon was like the perfect place to do this, but we barely left our house. Cause I think we were actually, that's when we launched Marketplace. And yeah, like I think we went out exploring like maybe 6 days out of the entire month. But like when we go, we would leave early in the morning and we wouldn't come back until like super late at night. Right. So that was our life for about a year.
That's great. So did you know what digital nomads and mobile bohemians? I've heard a lot of different terms for it, but did you know what that was even a thing before you started doing this?
No, we had no idea. And we didn't even do any research. Like, we're so impulsive.
Yeah.
We just looked at like how many ways we could cut down costs, and then we just like ran out and did it. Like, I think you were telling us like you had some tricks and you were able to get into like offices, like co-working spaces.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, we had no idea. We basically booked on Airbnb like a month at a time, because if you book a month then it's way cheaper.
Yeah,
so it was actually pretty awesome. In most of the countries our rent was much cheaper than what it was in Austin when we lived in Austin, so we actually saved money traveling somehow. But
no, it's actually surprising, but I definitely agree. I've saved a ton of money and I've lived a life that most people I know back home are super jealous of, but also, like you, though, I basically work all the time, and then, you know, I'll pop out into a new country and be like, hey, this is awesome. It, you know, it's different than when you leave your work in, let's say you're in Los Angeles all your life, you're like, wow, I'm still in Los Angeles. But you could be like, I'm in Budapest, or I'm in, you know, Tokyo or whatever. It's a totally different vibe, and it's, I don't know, there's just something very cool about it, and I definitely agree. I don't know. Yep. Yeah, I've been doing it for 3 years. You guys did a year, so you guys are lightweights. I've been doing it for 3 years, and there's no signs of stopping. Although I've kind of, like you, I've kind of set up shop in one place to kind of settle down for a little while. You guys are settled for the time being, correct?
We signed a 6 month lease, so
I signed a 1 year lease. So maybe I'm worse.
Maybe you feel this too, but like after doing something like this, I don't like, it's hard for me to picture living somewhere for a really long time. Like, I want to, it sounds really convenient and comfortable. Like, the hardest part about traveling was not having like a good bed all the time, you know, or like not having a good desk all the time. And those are things that we've actually like, we have really nice ones, because that's where we spend most of our lives, at our desk and in bed. But now I kind of feel like I don't know if I could ever settle down. There's like so much of the world to see, even like in the United States, right? Like, I never thought I would live in Colorado, but this state is just so magical. Like, it's so beautiful. And I, like, we've been almost everywhere in Colorado, just like driving as soon as we got here. And like, I feel like I could spend, I don't know, like a really long time living in different parts of Colorado.
6 months. Mountain. Maybe. Oh, no. Okay. 6 months in Mountain.
So I don't know. I don't know if I can like ever settle down.
Yeah. Once you get a taste, it's hard to do. I mean, like I'll probably be here for a year, but I'm still traveling. I just booked a flight to Taipei for a weekend, which I know you love Taipei, so I'm excited to go.
Man, Taipei is awesome. Is
the favorite place you went to? Yeah.
Yeah, like I actually, so people ask me all the time, and I'm sure they ask you, like, oh, what's your favorite country? Yeah. Like, what's your favorite place? And that was like the hardest question to answer. Not because I'm like a snob and I want to be complicated or anything, like, right. Just because they're so different. Like, it's really weird to be like, oh, this country is better. But I'm noticing, like, since I've stopped traveling, that there are a few countries that just keep popping up. And Taipei is definitely one. Like, there's so many beautiful places in Taiwan that we didn't even get to go to. So, but yeah, like Budapest, the one that I feel like I forced you to go to. So I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
And Lisbon, like those three, I'm constantly like, you know, like thinking about, like I think about them almost every single day. Wow. So
yeah, I just went back to Tokyo for a week, and it was, I don't know, it's a thing. I'm like, as soon as I get there and I start walking around, I get into a vibe, I'm like, wow, I could stay here for a long time. But then a week later, I'm like, no, I need to go somewhere else. I feel like I need to go back somewhere else and see something new. That's why it's hard. But the only place that I really feel like home that's not the U.S. is here in Thailand. I don't know why. It's just super chill, I guess. I don't know. There's something about it here that I really love, even though it's really hot. But yeah, this is the place I chose to sort of make my temporary home base for the next year here in Bangkok. And, you know, for the price of a closet-sized apartment probably in the U.S., I have a place on the 33rd floor that looks down on everything and has a, you know, an awesome infinity pool on the roof. And I mean, it's just crazy, like how much further your money can go when you're living somewhere like this.
So we'll see you in 6 months then.
Or what is it, 5 months?
well, I'll be in, that's the thing. I have like travel planned all for the whole year as well. It's just crazy. So even when I settle down, I can't settle down. But yeah, feel free to come visit.
You're not there. Don't worry about it. We'll water your plants.
That's fine. Okay, great. I don't have a pet yet, but maybe by then I will be that domesticated here in Thailand.
I doubt like it.
That's like really settled.
Yeah, exactly. No. That's not happening. I gotta stay mobile. But yeah, it's nice to not have to pack all my life into my backpack for once. I can like leave stuff here. Which is, one of the things that people like about being settled down. But it's something I haven't done for a while. I've had to literally pack everything in my life up into my backpack for the last couple of years, which is weird. Probably weird to a lot of people. And
yeah, it was kind of tedious.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, but you only do it once a month. I mean, it's not that bad. For me, sometimes it was like multiple times in a week and everything, and that would make me crazy.
Ugh, yeah. I actually ended up getting rid of a lot. Like, David and I had the really tiny carry-ons and a pack each, and that's all that we had.
Yep.
And now that like we have a closet and we have all this like storage, I have the hardest time like shopping. Like I'm still like buying things as I would if I needed to pack them into my bag.
Yep. I'm the same way. I don't want to buy things. Actually, I bought plates and glasses at IKEA, and I'm like thinking already, like, what am I going to do with these after a year? I gonna just leave them, throw them out, or something? Because definitely not taking them with me.
Yeah, we have four plates.
We have two spoons.
We have two spoons right now. It's like, that's maybe a little too little, you know.
Maybe. It depends on if you have a lot of friends. I don't know. I mean, one thing I miss about sort of being settled down is having a group of friends that I hang out with and, you know, cooking dinner. I love to cook, so cooking dinner for everyone and, you know, having parties and things like that. I kind of miss that, which is something
We're definitely coming to Thailand.
Jeez, what, I'll cook for you. Yeah, I have two little burners here, and that's about it. And no actual kitchen table, but it's fine. It's just for here, honestly, it's easier to just go out and cheaper to just go out and get food.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Sadly, but I'd love to cook. All right, do you, you know, one more quick question about this. I think my personal opinion is that for game developers, especially indie game developers, this is the perfect choice of lifestyle. I don't see why someone would live in a place like Seattle or San Francisco, aside from sort of the community that's there. But so much of the community is online. I don't know. You know, when you're sort of on a budget and you're trying to develop a game, it doesn't make any sense to me to pay ridiculous, you know, U.S. or you know, some European cities, you know, pay those prices to live when you could be traveling, working on, basically you would be free to work on the game if you have some money saved up. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think it's a viable option for indie developers to go this lifestyle?
Yeah, I think if you're able to do it, everyone should try to do it. Yeah. I think, especially like if you're creating something, it gives you so many different outlooks on life and like different, just like, yeah, the different cultures, the different areas of the world, even just like landscape, right? Like,
and architecture.
Yeah. Everything is just so, so kind of amazing to experience in person that, I think any sort of creative person should definitely do it. But then also I think it really does help to have that like change of scenery a lot of times, because development or creation of something, especially on a computer, can be so like kind of like lonely, or like you know, you can kind of like you're just working in a cave. Yeah. And to be able to then go out and experience something that is just so incredibly different than what you're used to is kind of like refreshing, you know. I think doing that over this past year has helped a lot. Like, we worked maybe way too much, and we probably shouldn't have, but to be able to, you know, go out, experience all these different cultures and areas of the world, I think is what kept us mostly sane. I don't think we would have been able to do it otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, the cool part, especially if you're programming all the time, just watching David program all the time, but like, really the smallest things are an accomplishment, right? Like just going outside, and because you're in a different country, everything is like really different and new to you. So that alone, like just stepping outside is an event. Like you just went to a party by going outside.
Right. No, I agree.
And one thing that I want to like mention is that it's actually really easy. So if all you need is your computer to work, like you can do this. It's super, super, super easy. It seems really intimidating. Like it's going to be really hard. You're going to have to like book all these crazy flights and you're not going to know the language, but literally none of that matters. And everyone speaks English everywhere. So.
Well, except not everywhere.
Except South Korea.
You going to China or something? I've had difficulties in China.
China. Yeah. We haven't gone, but we've definitely heard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I'm in the middle of China, where I mean, I wouldn't see foreigners for maybe one or two in a week. So, there are places where it's difficult, but there are tons of places. Like here in Bangkok, you know, if you don't speak Thai, you can get by for the most part. You'd be fine. In Chiang Mai, I think that's where a lot of the nomads go. I'm sure there's tons of English speaking going on there. So, I mean, even for sort of travel newbies, a lot of it isn't that difficult. And yeah, when I went to Amsterdam and Budapest, it was like easy mode for traveling. I mean, everyone speaks English. It's like everything's sort of super normal. It's way easier. So, yeah.
I think, I mean, we went to Sicily, which was definitely harder. And there, even then, you know, like you get by. If you need things, you just point, right? Like money, you know, most like whatever, they're number symbols, right? So it's like pretty easy to do most things, even if you can't speak.
Right. But in, even if you know you're going somewhere, I mean, it takes you a day or two to memorize their numbers or, you know, just some basic like hello and thank you and all that. I mean, I use something called Speak Sheets, which they'll sell you basically a PDF with just like the various basic phrases and things that you would need to know. I think I paid $20 for like 20 different countries, big package just in case. But I mean,
I'll wait till it goes on sale. I'll wait till it's in a sale. You know, like a
yeah, sale. When it's on Humble Bundle. The
digital 20 sounds Humble like Bundle. A lot of money. I don't know.
Yeah. It's definitely worth it, I think. I put them into a program or an app called Anki, A-N-K-I. It's like a flashcard, spaced repetition flashcard app. It's what I used to study for the bar, and it's what I use to study languages now. I'm learning German, and I'm learning Thai, and I'm learning how to read Japanese kanji. So all that stuff, you know, every day I do, you know, 30 minutes or an hour of practicing and just going through my flashcards. It sounds like a lot, but it's actually kind of fun. You can do it at the gym. You can do it on the subway. You can do it wherever you're going and sort of gives your mind a break from whatever normal work you're doing. So that's tip number one, learning languages, is to use something called spaced repetition flashcards. So number two, wait, because you had talked about tips before. Number two is working at a Regus office, which R-E-G-U-S. I don't work at cafes. I work at like an actual real office. It's like a business lounge where they have some cubicles set up and maybe a table or some desks and things. And I pay $40 a month for basically an office to use every day, which is wild. It's unbelievably cheap. And they're all over the world. So I can go wherever, whatever city I'm in, I can show up to one of these offices, show my card, and I'll have a seat. And some free internet, free coffee, free tea, all that stuff. It's all taken care of.
Man, I wish we knew that.
Yeah, it's awesome. Because then, like you were saying, where you're sort of at home and there's not like a great desk or whatever. I've never been in a place with a great desk where I could sit down and work at any place I've traveled in the last 3 years. But the Regus offices are generally pretty good.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That sounds really good. In Taiwan, we actually gave up and... got a co-working place for like a month.
Right, but what do you pay for? Like, I know that they've always been more expensive than what I pay for the Regus office. So if cost savings are a thing, what do you pay for a co-working space generally?
So, I mean, it's different everywhere, and it was super cheap in Taipei.
That's good.
And that was like, I want to say $100 each for a full month.
That's not bad.
And that's like unheard of.
Right.
You know.
Right. I mean, but you're still going to pay thousands probably at San Francisco co-working space.
Totally.
Like, well, we actually had a co-working space in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
But we had our own office in it, like those WeWork
things. Yeah, WeWork.
And, man, how much was it? We got a deal, too. So this was like...
It was like, I think, $1,000 per month, right? No, it was
$500. Yeah.
Okay, it was... $500 per month, but when we were leaving, and we had like a two-person actual office.
We could barely fit like two desks.
Right, yeah. I know those offices.
And when we were leaving, we overheard the people trying to like, you know, rent out our office. And they were asking like, I think $1,600 a month for it.
You guys got a good deal.
Wow. Regus. I think we would have definitely done that if we remembered you telling us.
Well, and you can also rent like a real office and everything. I know people that run their business. I mean, there are even here, there are a bunch of businesses being run out of there and they have like a real office, like you said. I mean, they're maybe bigger or smaller. So there's different levels and depending on how much you want to pay and how permanent your situation is. Right. But it's, in any case, it's probably cheaper than having like a real office. And I mean, it's not as cheap as just doing it at home, but if you're sort of being mobile, you don't always have the most comfortable place at home. So it's definitely helpful. And also, I find that it's helpful to get there and there's like other people working and I can talk to, you feel like a real, you're really in business and you're really working. And it separates your home and your work life. Even though I actually work, because I'm 16 hours ahead or whatever, I need to work at midnight all the time. So I do have a little space set up here, but generally I can get my work done during the day.
I think it's also like, depending on the country, you might end up in a pretty small space, you know, for living.
Definitely.
So,
I have one more tip and then we're going to wrap it up. You talked about flights and dealing with flights and everything. And I think one of the things I hear all the time is that it's just too expensive to fly out of the US or whatever. If you use an app called Skyscanner, that is the best. I don't know if you use Skyscanner to look for flights, but like, especially if you have no particular destination in mind, you basically search from where you are to everywhere over the net, and you can even pick like a month. Just say, okay, in February I want to go. That's what I did with Taipei. I was like, okay, I can go everywhere in February, so show me what's going to be cheap and what's going to be within my range. And I found one that was, you know, a flight that was around $200 around trip. Boom, there we go, we're done. I'm going to Taipei. This is it was super easy, and it'll just show you every country in, you know, ascending order of price, and you just pick whatever whatever you want to do. It's awesome. Skyscanner's the best.
Yeah.
Definitely. All right. So let's wrap this up. Guys, where can we find you?
You can find us on Twitter, just at GameJolt. And I'd give out my actual Twitter, but I don't really use it properly. Okay. So if you message at GameJolt, you'll get me.
Yeah, Yaprak does Jolt, and I code. I'm at on Twitter. It's they took cross with one S, CROS.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but
no explanation needed.
Yeah, I'm pretty inactive just because, I don't know. I'm not much for social media stuff.
It's understandable. Okay. And then obviously www.gamejolt.com would be where you would find GameJolt, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
Great. You can find me at gamelawyerblog.com and on Twitter at Z Strebeck, Strebeck. Excuse me, Z Strebeck. That would be the best. And on Instagram, if you want to see my dumb traveling photos, I was just in Tokyo and saw some sumo wrestlers wrestling. So I put some videos that were pretty cool. It was pretty wild. I was trying out the new slow motion function on my phone. So I did some.
I'm sure that's pretty.
Well, there is a lot of movement in the bodies of these sumo wrestlers, so it's fascinating to see when they hit each other. Yeah, it was a good candidate for slow motion. Yeah. All right, guys, thank you for coming on, and I look forward to what happens with GameJolt in 2017. Maybe we can have you back on, and listeners, look forward to next year. I'm sure I haven't planned it yet, but I'm sure I have wonderful things in store for you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
No problem. See you.